This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. The number of dead from an explosion outside a school in Afghanistan's capital of Kabul has risen to 58, Afghan officials said Sunday, as doctors struggled to provide medical care to at least 150 injured, mostly girls. Sunday, civilians and policemen collected books and school bags strewn across a blood-stained road that was busy with shoppers ahead of this year's celebration for Eid al-Fitr next week. A car bomb was detonated in front of the school Saturday evening. When students rushed out in panic, two more exploded. Clashes erupted between Palestinian protesters and Israeli police outside the Old City of Jerusalem Saturday night as tens of thousands of Muslim worshippers prayed at the nearby Al-Aqsa Mosque on Islam's holy night of Layl al-Qadr. Palestinian youth threw stones, lit fires, and tore down police barricades in the streets leading to the walled Old City gates as officers on horseback and in riot gear used stun grenades and water cannons to repel them. At least 80 people were injured and 14 were taken to the hospital, the Palestine Red Crescent said. Israeli police said at least one officer was hurt. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the attack and expressed his deepest sympathies to the families of the victims and to the government and people of Afghanistan. In a statement, he also stressed the urgency of ending the violence in Afghanistan. Jordan warned Israel Sunday to stop what it described as barbaric attacks, said it would step up the international pressure, an official statement said. The kingdom has custodianship of Muslim and Christian sites in Jerusalem. It said Israel should respect worshippers and international law. This is VOA News. A large segment of a Chinese rocket entered Earth's atmosphere and disintegrated over the Indian Ocean Sunday, China's space agency said, following fevered speculation over where the 18-ton object would come down. Officials in Beijing had said there was little risk from the free-falling segment of the rocket, which had launched the first module of China's new space station into Earth orbit April 29th. But the U.S. Space Agency NASA and some experts said China had behaved irresponsibly, as an uncontrolled re-entry of such a large object risked damage and casualties. Chinese officials said it landed in the Indian Ocean near the Maldives and that most of it disintegrated and was destroyed during descent. Emirates Airlines said Sunday it will fly medical supplies from Dubai to 9 cities in India free of charge starting this week to help battle a devastating upsurge in the coronavirus. In an AP interview, Nabul Sultan, the divisional senior vice president for the airline, says high volumes of certain key items will be flown to India very soon.
We are looking at various requests at the moment for some of these essential commodities that needs to move to India. As a matter of fact, as we speak, we are already preparing the first shipment that is booked on 13th of May that consists of a lot of tents or hospital tents that will be sort of moved as quickly as possible.
International aid is poured in for India, where record infection rates have overwhelmed hospitals, depleting medicines, oxygen tanks, and other supplies. India reports a record new COVID-19 daily death toll of over 4,000 and more than 400,000 new cases as the country grapples with the world's worst coronavirus surge. Members of the opposition call on Prime Minister Narendra Modi to order a national lockdown, as the country's death toll to date hit nearly 240,000. President Vladimir Putin watched Russia's traditional World War II victory parade Sunday. This year it coincides with soaring tensions with the West. The patriotic display of raw military power on Moscow's Red Square featured over 12,000 troops and more than 190 pieces of military hardware, including intercontinental ballistic missiles launchers and a flypast by nearly 80 military aircraft under cloudy skies. It commemorates the 76th anniversary of the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. Putin, who has been in power as either president or prime minister since 1999, stood beside Soviet war veterans.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Care of the vice presidency in charge of the security. If their main concern is about security, then let them take care of the security aspects, and the rest of the people of Chad will organize, you know, the rest of the activities which are necessary for peaceful transition, etc.
A Chadian opposition leader says protest against the Transitional Military Council will continue despite the imposed ban on demonstrations.
To make sure that we are able to turn around the economic scenario of the country. So for us, we think that this is a good move. It's in the best interest of the nation, then best interest of political parties, PF and the Green Party.
A major Zambian opposition party leader endorses incumbent President Edgar Chagwa Lungu ahead of the upcoming August 12 general election.
Hoping that the MONUSCO will do their job to protect the people, especially minorities. If not, there are many reasons and many ways others that they are doing, which will not stop the people to continue to protest.
And groups from the Democratic Republic of Congo in the diaspora plan to demonstrate across U.S. state capitals and Washington, D.C. this week. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Chad, the leader of the opposition Transformers Party says protests against the Transitional Military Council will continue despite the imposed ban on demonstrations. Dr. Success Masra says opposition groups will not hold talks with those responsible for violating the country's constitution by seizing power through force. He called on the international community to join the opposition to pressure the military junta to hand over power to civilian leadership as stipulated in the constitution. His remarks come after police tear gas protesters who had defied a ban on demonstrations against the junta Saturday. Organized by civil society and opposition parties, the demonstrators demanded that the junta step down. They said the country is not a dynasty, so the former president's son should not be the country's leader. Four-star General Mahmoud Idriss Deby, son of the former president, was named head of the Transitional Military Council following the death of his father. The junta says it will lead the country to democratic elections within 18 months. But Dr. Success Masra rejects the leadership of the junta. He tells me that the international community, including the African Union and the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, should join efforts with the opposition to pressure the junta to hand over power.
The peaceful protest of today is in the continuity. We recorded more than 50 people arrested and 15 people wounded. So this shows clearly that the situation is getting worse in this country. Our country has been subjected to a dynastic military coup, and now without the willing of the people of Chad. My headquarters is surrounded by a part of the army. My passport is being withheld by the authorities, which really shows that this country is going, it is taking a very bad direction. I officially, 3 days back, I sent a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations, because this is a coup, and this is like confiscating the power using weapons, which is not acceptable in this country. And we want official protection from the United Nations to make sure that the voice of the people of Chad could be heard in this country.
Officials are saying that the police fired tear gas to disperse the protesters because the protesters defied a ban to demonstrate against the military junta and because of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. Why did they defy the ban?
This is very curious. You are talking of authorities? No. Of people who came in power by destroying the constitution of the country. They came in power destroying the status of the African Union. This is a coup d'etat. And those people who came in power, they shouldn't be where they are. And they are now asking the people of Chad to request from them an authorization to work for freedom and for justice and for inclusion and for the respect of laws in this country. So how can you imagine this is possible? It clearly shows that what they have to do is very clear. And this is what people of Chad are requesting, acting in the name of the people of Chad. And this is very important for them to understand.
Does that mean opposition groups, including your party and your supporters, will continue protesting despite the imposed ban by the military junta?
Yes, not only we will continue to organize peaceful protests, but in the coming days, we, the people of Chad, we will put in place an organization which is going to be more inclusive, which is going to represent the voice of the people of Chad. Because people of Chad, they don't want those who come in power using weapons. Instead, we believe in democracy. So this is going to be put in place. And based on that, we will ask officially the United Nations, the partners of Chad, the African Union, to be with the people of Chad and not to recognize this situation of coup d'etat, which is really a dynastic transmission of power. So this is going to be the continuation of our struggle in the name of our people, because our people is marching to give a life to our national anthem, which says, people of Chad, stand up because your freedom will stem from your courage. This is what we are doing for our people, and we will continue until the justice become the rule in this country.
But the Transitional Military Council says that it will organize free, democratic, and transparent elections within 18 months. Why are the people not happy about this? Why wouldn't you engage them to ensure a smooth process towards the election?
No, because this is a coup d'etat organized by the son of the former president. Is that correct for people? No, this is not correct, number one. Number two, if they want people to believe in them, let them start with something. Let's put in a civil president, and then they become number two of that executive power, becoming the vice presidency. They can take care of the vice presidency in charge of the security. If their main concern is about security, then let them take care of the security aspects, and the rest of the people of Chad will organize, you know, the rest of the activities which are necessary for peaceful transition, etc. And if they want to make sure that people can believe in them, let them start with that. And the second thing they have to do is to look at the chart. If you look at this chart, this is a chart for a king. It's not a chart for a president.
Dr. Sasses Masra is the leader of the Chadian Opposition Transformers Party. He spoke with me from the capital in N'Djamena. In Zambia, the leader of the opposition Green Party has endorsed incumbent President Edgar Lungu ahead of the upcoming August 12 general election. Peter Sikamba endorsed the president at a news conference in the capital, Lusaka, Saturday. The opposition figure says he sees no winds of change blowing on the ground, dismissing the anticipated stiff challenge from main opposition leader Hakainde Hichilema. Analysts say the alliance between Hichilema's main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, and the National Democratic Congress, or NDC, could pose a significant threat to President Lungu's re-election bid. They, however, add that similar endorsements from opposition figures could thwart the electoral prospects of the alliance. To learn more about the reasons behind the support of President Lungu's re-election bid, I reach Peter Sinkamba, leader of the opposition Green Party.
Looking at the 2021 August 12 elections, there is no wind of change in the country at the moment. All pointers are showing that President Edgar Lungu is going to win the elections. Now, in the event that we do not render support at this point in time, we could probably create an opportunity where other political parties could win the election. And then that is likely to distract a number of programs that we have lined up with the PF government.
Some people are saying that your endorsement comes as a result of perhaps the government implementing some of the policies that the Green Party has been advocating, including the marijuana export, which some people believe could resolve some of the economic challenges the country faces. Is this the case?
Yes, exactly. That is the position. Because you see, for you to be in opposition, you must serve two purposes. Number one is to create what we call the checks and balances. Number two, you must have an alternative economic and social agenda. Now, if a party in government starts implementing some of the alternative party agenda that you are promoting as an opposition party, then it just makes sense to work in collaboration with the party in government to make sure that those alternative programs can be implemented.
Some people are suggesting that you are setting your presidential ambition aside to support the president on selfish grounds because you are hoping that the president will make you or put you in charge of marijuana export. How do you respond to that?
Well, that is not entirely the position. The position is that this country is highly indebted. We have to pay like $750 million next year towards the Eurobond repayment. We have to pay another $1 billion the following year, which is matures in 2024. And we have huge socio-economic challenges that need alternative revenue streams. So if we were to have another political party coming in to run our country next August, chances are that these programs which could bring in alternative revenue cannot be implemented. And therefore, we will land in serious economic problems in the next 1-2 years. So for me, I'd rather I sacrifice my ambition of presidency for national interest so that we are able to implement this marijuana program effectively and see how we can be able to dismantle the loan challenge that we have in terms of Eurobond, especially, which already in the last 3-4 months, government has defaulted to pay since due coupons.
Some people are suggesting that you have been paid by the Patriotic Front or the government to be a pseudo opposition leader just to endorse the president in time for the election. Do you think their criticisms are justified?
No, the criticisms are not justified. You know, for us, when we engage PF, we engage PF from a very objective point of view, not from a malicious point of view. And many times when we have advised them on issues, they've always heard us. You know, there were times, for example, when the other opposition leader, the leading opposition leader, UPND, was incarcerated on some treason charges. It had to take me to engage my colleagues in the government to see if we could resolve that issue amicably, and it was done.
With this endorsement, will the Green Party participate in the parliamentary elections?
Yes, at parliamentary level, we are going to participate, and even at local government level, we are going to participate. It's only the presidential one where we have agreed that we are going to rally behind President Edgar Lungu to make sure that he wins the election in the upcoming election in August. And then once that is done, then we can implement the programs, the agriculture programs, and the some renewable energy programs for the Green Party and some mining programs for the Green Party to make sure that we are able to turn around the economic scenario of the country. So for us, we think that this is a good move. It's in the best interest of the nation than best interest of political parties, PF and the Green Party.
Peter Sinkamba is leader of the Zambian opposition Green Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka.
Groups from the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, in the diaspora plan to demonstrate across U.S. state capitals and Washington, D.C. this week. The protests aim to denounce what the groups say are ongoing attacks against the Banyamulenge ethnic group back home in Congo. The attacks, they say, appear to be ethnic cleansing. The planned demonstrations come after local media reported a surge in violence in areas predominantly inhabited by the group. The violence has reportedly forced tens of thousands of civilians to flee their homes and have sharply increased the numbers of internally displaced persons. Jean-Paul Ruhosha is the executive director for Congo Today, an NGO that focuses on reconciliation and economic development in the DRC. He is also a lead organizer of the protests. Ruhosha tells me that the U.S. lawmakers should impose stiff sanctions on those responsible for the ongoing violence.
The purpose of it is to explain exactly what's happening in the DRC, the ethnic chasing of Banyamulenge, and the discrimination they are facing, rape and the crime, all that. And we are trying to raise a voice to tell the international community, American neighbors, to know and to intervene to see if we can stop what's been going on for more than 3 years.
Will there be a petition presented to the authorities here in the U.S.?
Of course, yes. All the representatives, all the states, all those people who will go in every city, every state, they will have petition as well. They will be explaining exactly what's happening and what do we think that the people should do to help to prevent this genocide that is going on.
But Jean-Paul, some people are suggesting that it is not only the Banyamulenges who are facing some form of challenges due to conflict in the areas they inhabit, and that other ethnic groups face similar instances of conflict in the areas that they reside.
I was just on a BBC a few minutes ago, and the reason that I was there was talking about the issue of Ituri and the issue of North Kivu. But that the president of the Republic did take care of that, the Ituri and North Kivu. He nominated the military, the generals, to be the governor. He doesn't want any more civilian to be the governor. He wants the military to take over and to resolve the issue. But it didn't happen in South Kivu, where the Banyamulenge are being killed. That's why we are raising voice. That's why we need help. And even the military, the DRC military, have been cooperating with the same Mai Mai and the Redi Tabara that we talked about, who are chasing Banyamulenge. That's why we think that we needed to talk about Banyamulenge more than anybody else. No one else is being targeted like they do. And remember, they are minority people. Remember, they are Tutsi.
Well, but Jean-Paul, officials of the military have denied that they are involved in any violence or in cooperation with Mai Mai or rebel groups to attack the Banyamulenges. And that all they do, the AFRDC says, is to protect life and property, and that is what they are doing, backed by MONUSCO. So the allegations they deny is false.
Well, I knew they will deny it, but there are evidence proving that they are not doing what they are supposed to do. What would you say when the civilians are being killed in 1 mile where the military are? What would you say in 6 miles there is a MONUSCO, but the civilians are being killed? Their cows are being taken, their houses are being burned. What would you say about that?
But do you have compiled evidence that you present as part of your petition?
Of course. We have witnesses who witnessed that. We have the area. We have a card that what we call map in the United States that shows where the base is, it shows where the civilians are being killed. And we even have some cases where the people went to the MONUSCO and they went to the government to plead for their safety, and then they've been turned away. And not only that, we will have some cases that the Congolese military actually killed the Banyamulenge when they come to fight for their right, what I call for their right. They taken their cows, and then they went to fight with the group, Mai Mai, that who take their cows. On their way back, they was killed. Five of them was killed. So that, to me, is more than evidence. And no one will deny that.
So what happens next after the protest on May 14th?
What the community will do next, that's the good question. We are not going to stop. We are going to continue, and we will do. We will raise our voice, and we are hoping for our voice to be heard. We're hoping that the international community will intervene. We are hoping that the government of Congo will listen. We are hoping that MONUSCO will do their job to protect the people, especially minority. If not, there are many reasons and many ways other that they are doing, which will will not stop the people to continue to protest.
Jean-Paul Ruhosha is the executive director for Congo Today, an NGO that focuses on reconciliation and economic development in the DRC. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. The U.S. Library of Congress has accepted a book by young author Michael Jerome titled The Story of the Spirit of Reunion Island. The book explores the spirituality of the island's residents. It also explores the mysticism and animal rituals practiced by its people. Local media reports residents have been ecstatic following news that the book depicting their ways of life has been accepted by the U.S. Library of Congress. For more reaction, I reach the book's author, Michael Jerome, in Reunion Island's capital, St. Denis.
My first reaction was a reaction of surprise, because when I wrote my books, I was not expected that that book would be in Library of Congress. You know, I'm from Reunion Island, an island in East Africa, and we had a struggle, a long, long struggle to get recognized, and a long struggle against some form of injustice, because we got a lot of problems, like a lot of countries back in the day, like slavery and segregation, you know, like a lot of countries. It was really a surprise, because I wrote a book on the mysticism in my island, because we have a strong link with voodoo and all the spiritual animists.
What motivated you to write this book?
My motivation, first of all, was, you know, write something about my island, write something about my community, write something about my story, you know, because I was born on a mystical camp, you know, and whole camp. From in St. Louis of Reunion Island, you know, it was a whole camp where the slaves were detained, you know, my ancestors were detained. And I was born there. When I was a little boy, I saw some spiritual things, you know, and so it was normal for me, because the mysticism for us is so, you know, normal, you know, that's natural for us, you know, we are animists. And for us, and it was my first motivation, tell our story.
How are people in Reunion reacting to your book now that they are aware that it has been at the U.S. Library of Congress?
Good reaction, you know, because it's about us. This book is raw. You know, not a lot of people wrote about the mysticism in Reunion Island. So the reaction were good. It was amazing. It was a surprise, but, you know, it's cool, you know, being Library of Congress, but I cannot stop here, you know. I have to go forward in some new projects, like, you know, I'm a cartoon director too, you know. I got my project with my brotherhood and my association. We work with Mozambique right now, okay, with Mozambique government, because in Reunion Island you have a lot of Mozambican descendants, and I have to represent my ancestors too, the King Reynard Rivuni, because I'm a descendant of him. The King Reynard Rivuni was the last king of Madagascar, you know. He was from the same caste, the Hova caste, you know. So a lot of projects to represent my island, to represent my ancestors. But I have some projects in writing too, you know. So I keep going on. I go forward and I will see.
Michael Jerome is a young author from Reunion Island. He spoke with me from the capital, St. Denis. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half, Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs and Music from African Collection. But first, Dr. Sayave Numu, a prominent France-based physician, says telemedicine and technological innovations can be deployed to significantly improve healthcare delivery systems across Africa. He says they can also be used in remote parts of Africa with infrastructural and telecommunication challenges. Dr. Numu is a founding member of the French-speaking Academy of Telemedicine in France and a former surgeon at the American Hospital in Neuilly outside of Paris. He tells me that telemedicine used by competent doctors can be used to help with efforts of governments in Africa to limit the spread of the coronavirus as well as combat the trafficking of fake drugs.
Okay, briefly, telemedicine is just, as you know, something to make a remote diagnosis. So we have a couple of tools that you can transport in every places, even where there is no power, and you can make clinical diagnosis, blood tests, urine analyze, ultrasound, lot of information you can collect, and you will have a connection with a remote doctor that can be in a big city or even in the U.S. who can assist you. And this is how we are working. We also help, for example, a hospital to have a very good system to manage the hospital and manage the clinical data, particularly an electronic medical records, to make the hospital work properly. Even in a country level, we can set up for them repositories so that everyone is speaking the same language. This is our main activities.
So, Dr. Nimu, where you work in Africa, in some of these remote villages with sometimes no electricity or even internet access, how effective is telemedicine in these areas?
Okay, in these areas, there are two things. For example, when we go with our tools to make some diagnosis, we have batteries, long-life batteries. This was specially made for our solution. We have some antennas that can be connected even using the satellite. But on the other side, right now, I can tell you in a lot of Africa countries, even the remote area, they have mobile phone connections. They don't have light, but they have mobile phones. So it means the network is there, and we will use whatever network is there for that. There are also a lot of places where they have sun power panels. It even became some business for the remote area where in a small village they can have someone with a sun power panel, and he's making the charge of all the mobile phones. You know that from here, I can send a money to anyone in any place, almost any place, any remote village in Africa, using only my mobile phone, and he will get it. So instead of sending money, we can also send health.
Dr. Numu, so what do you think are the technological innovations that could help promote health in Africa?
So all this is a question of data. For example, what you are doing today, according to what you are doing today, to your lifestyle, there are some illnesses that we know that you are exposed to them. This is how we can make prevention. Example is that, you know, the weight in the your environment can tell us when will be the first case of meningitis. It's linked. So if you have a solution to collect it, to take data and to send it immediately, then you can alert people, okay, you have to do this. So this is how technology use. It's faster, and also it's quicker. And nowadays, for example, usually when I go there, I can have in my pocket an ultrasound machine. This is very performant, very good. And this one doesn't need to be connected to power. And it's a ultrasound. Otherwise, you go in the hospital, it's the big table that they are rolling to make a ultrasound put to a pregnant lady. Now I can get it in my pocket thanks to technology. And it's independent. This is what technology is making.
So with your organization using telemedicine to help in the fight against diseases, how could telemedicine help fight pandemics, including COVID-19 and its many variants?
Across Africa, the problem can be a little bit more simple. Do you know how they know that someone has a COVID? When the COVID started, we set up a small tablet. This is using like an Android or iPhone or any kind of iOS or Android, whereby he was saying, we will give this to every small village where there is a small health center. This small health center, usually it's drive by a single nurse alone. She will do everything. So we plan to say, give it to her. She has only one temperature tool, one blood pressure, one tool to take the SpO2, meaning the oxygen in the blood. It's very simple. It's not expensive. It's something that is in the pocket of everyone. And then we can collect combined sign, meaning someone who have fever, who is coughing in terms of clinical sign, who has, for example, his oxygen blood is going down. Those information, we collect a couple of information for this. Every time one man who is having this must be alerted to a central place and take decision to make the test or not.
Dr. Seyave Numu is a founding member of the French-speaking Academy of Telemedicine in France and a former surgeon at the American Hospital in newly outside of Paris. He spoke with me from the French capital, Paris. African nations have welcomed the news that the U.S. supports a proposal to waive intellectual property protections for COVID-19 vaccines. But they warn the road ahead is long and full of obstacles. VOA's Anita Powell speaks to health policy experts and reports from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Health experts and activists say the decision, announced this week by the U.S. Trade Representative, could save lives in parts of the world where the coronavirus pandemic continues to rage and vaccines are in short supply. Fatima Hassan is director of the Health Justice Initiative, a South African group that advocates equitable health care. While Hassan said she welcomes U.S. support of the so-called TRIPS waiver, it stands for trade-related aspects of intellectual property, she worries that the process is moving too slowly.
Obviously, where we welcome the Biden administration's announcement, and really he's giving effect partially to a promise he made when he was campaigning to be the president of the United States. So even though it's 8 months too late, we still do welcome it. It is a small step to be able to go forward in terms of the TRIPS waiver, but also in terms of other initiatives to scale up manufacturing, not just in Africa, but in parts of the global south, particularly in Latin America and Asia as well.
The waiver idea came from two nations that have suffered greatly under the pandemic, South Africa and India. South Africa is the continent's worst hit country, with nearly 1.6 million confirmed cases and a vaccination program that has been plagued by fits and starts. Hassan stressed that the waiver alone won't immediately produce a bounty of locally produced vaccines. The Africa Centers for Disease Control has identified about 6 facilities on the continent that are capable of manufacturing vaccines, hardly enough to quickly meet the needs of more than 1.2 billion Africans. And, says Yuan Kyung-hu of Global Aid Group Doctors Without Borders, the U.S. does not have the final word here. The World Trade Organization only meets in June to hammer out the conditions, and there are a number of high-profile opponents, including the European Union, Canada, Switzerland, Japan, Germany, Brazil, and Australia. That opposition may be, in part, because of what Hassan wants to happen next.
And maybe the statement from the U.S. Trade Office is actually the first of a long journey where over the next few decades we'll finally be able to have a real reckoning around the impact of intellectual property on access to healthcare services, in particular medicine. The fact that medicines are still commodified, that they are subject to a trade regime and subject to the, you know, quite excessive and quite protectionist rules of the World Trade Organization is a key concern for many organizations and many health access advocates and activists.
Umunyana Rugege, director of South African advocacy group Section 27, certainly hopes that is the case. It campaigns for social justice in South Africa. Before COVID-19 appeared, its health advocacy focused on another pandemic, HIV. Rugege said South Africa's lengthy experience in that battle enabled it to act quickly when COVID-19 first appeared.
Early in the pandemic, what we did was to call for a number of things. The first thing was a moratorium on any new patents on COVID-related technologies. So that's before we even had vaccines, before we knew what treatments were going to work. We said, let's make sure that we're not giving out new patents on these technologies. The second thing what we demanded was for automatic compulsory licenses where there are health technologies that are found to be effective against COVID, but that have patents.
This is familiar ground for African health activists. Starting the mid-1990s, activists lobbied hard for the World Trade Organization to issue a similar waiver for life-saving antiretroviral medications. A final agreement was only inked in 2001. The United Nations says as many as 42 million people have died of AIDS-related illnesses since counting began more than 40 years ago. Since COVID-19 was first recognized in early 2020, the World Health Organization says it has killed 3.2 million people. Anita Pal, VOA News, Johannesburg.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The opening group matches of Africa's qualifying campaign for the 2022 World Cup have been postponed. The group stage of the qualifiers were due to be played in June, but now FIFA says the campaign will start in September. According to FIFA, the postponement is due to the current disruption caused by the COVID-19 pandemic and the need to ensure optimal playing conditions for all players. The qualifiers for the FIFA World Cup Qatar 2022 are now scheduled to take place in the existing windows of September, October and November 2021 and March 2022. A total of 40 African nations are competing for one of the five places for the continent at the finals in Qatar. The teams have been drawn into 10 groups of four nations, with only the pool winners progressing to a final playoff phase to decide the teams going to Qatar. Meanwhile, Belgian Hugo Broos has been appointed as the new coach of South Africa's men's national football team, Bafana Bafana, on a five-year deal. He's expected in South Africa this week to begin his new job. His first games in charge will likely be the opening rounds of the 2022 World Cup qualifiers against neighbor Zimbabwe before hosting Ghana. The 69-year-old replaces Molefi Nseki, who was sacked in March after Bafana Bafana failed to qualify for next year's Africa Cup of Nations finals in Cameroon. Rose led Cameroon to the 2017 Nations Cup title in Gabon as they came from behind to beat Egypt 2-1 in the final. In Olympic news, Japan has extended COVID-19 restrictions just less than 3 months before the Tokyo Olympics. Restrictions in some cities had been due to end on May 11th, but will now remain in place until the end of the month. The move casts more doubt on whether the Olympics will go ahead as planned. However, local media report that some rules will still be eased, such as allowing a limited number of fans back into sports stadiums, despite other restrictions being extended. The Olympics are due to begin in Tokyo on July 23rd. They were postponed from 2020 because of the pandemic. More than 10,000 athletes from 200 countries and regions are due to take part. And a Kenyan amputee footballer has joined the Turkish team. Brian Oroka Ocheng joined Eyübe FC last month, signing a two-year contract with the Turkish side. The 29-year-old started playing football at the age of 18 and has played for various teams, including the Kenyan national side. According to media reports, due to the limited opportunities in his country, he decided to leave for Turkey, who have been past champions in amputee football. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Is it possible for African states to pursue a common purpose in the attainment of their security and peace in the continent? This is a question that deserves urgent attention. However, here is an example to take note of. Recently, it was announced that President Buhari of Nigeria have been in contact with U.S. officials and have made the proposal that the United States should station its African command headquarters in the African continent to assist in tackling the jihadist threats in the Sahel and Central Africa. This report came as a surprise to many, particularly to those who are involved in security and foreign policy issues on the African continent. It may be recalled that in the past, the African Union and previously the OAU are calling all of its member states not to allow foreign bases to be stationed on African soil. By and large, many African states are complied with that request by the continental bodies. But this issue took on great urgency when former President Walker Bush paid an official visit to Ghana just before he left office. At that time, there were rumors that efforts are continuing to deploy AFRICOM on the African soil. And the African states urged the Ghanaian president, who will be the host of President Bush, to make it clear that Africa could not tolerate the stationing of the U.S. African Command on African soil. The Ghanaian president raised the issue and he informed President Bush that Africa would not support such a move. In response, President Walker Bush gave a solemn commitment that the United States had no plans whatsoever to station the African Command on African soil, and that the African Command will be stationed outside the African continent. By and large, this commitment has been kept by the United States. The only exception one can say may be for what is happening in Djibouti at the Horn of Africa, where you have France, the United States, and China having bases in that and that territory. One must also recall that few years ago, reports came to the United States and the world that 5 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Niger in contact with rebels in the Sahel. Many in Congress and the foreign policy circle in the United States were shocked to discover that American troops were in Africa following the withdrawal, of course, of African troops from the case of Somalia in the early 1990s. The Pentagon conducted an examination and all of these troops were withdrawn. The question is then, did President Buhari and his officials conduct consultations with all African states, or at least the majority of African states, in this change of position? Nigeria is an important African state with the largest African population with great influence on the continent. What warrants this change in the position of Nigeria? So the question now is, what will happen? Did Nigeria believe that President Biden would be able to give a positive answer? Do not forget that presently the president is under some attack because he had decided to withdraw U.S. troops from Afghanistan till the end of September. So this is an issue which deserves some reflection by many African states. These are serious matters and should not be treated lightly. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
Fella me, fella me, fella me, fella.
And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Now, baby, take it up. When I buy a down.
That was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Bill Eagle, Reporter Douglas Impuga, and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the leech that does not let go even when it is filled dies on the dry land. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.